Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Regular listeners may notice that this episode is coming out a little bit later than normal. That's because two of us were not permitted to see the film, Meg 2, in a press screening. We had to hotfoot it to the cinema on first thing on a Friday morning. Not great, but the things we do to create podcasts. Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Catherine Bray.
And I'm Yasmin Omar.
On the show this week, the giant shark is back to battle Jason Statham in Meg 2. Traumas are unearthed in Paris Memories. And on Film Club, the sharks are regular size, but they got clever in Deep Blue Sea. All coming up in Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Also, just worth noting, last week's episode, we talked about You Hurt My Feelings and got to speak to Nicole Holofcener. And actually, the film's release was pushed and we weren't fully aware of that. And it is now out on the 8th on Amazon Prime. Very much worth catching up with. So, how are you both? I mean, Catherine, we've had a cursed morning together, so maybe we should go with Yasmin, who's had hopefully a less bad time. How are you, Yasmin?
Yeah, good. I mean, it's been a nice summer. I've seen Barbie 3 times. I've seen Mission Impossible 3 times. Just been a really nice time at the movies, to be honest.
Well, I mean, these things are going to change because there are quite a few terrible weeks ahead. So, I mean, I hope people have like saved up their Barbie and Oppenheimer rewatches because like, if you want to go to the cinema, those are your best options, I think, for the next few weeks. Catherine, are you recovered from what we've just been through? Do you want to explain what happened?
I mean, as you say, it's been a good few weeks. We've had Barbie, Oppenheimer, then Talk to Me last week. The Turtles movie is really good. And then it's just fallen off a Mariana-like trench into the depths. We've been to see the Meg 2, or we tried to see the Meg 2. We tried to go to the press screening. There weren't apparently any spots at the press screening. So we tried to go to the first public screening at the O2, which was in 4DX at the Cineworld there, only to get there and be told that the 4DX screen was full of smoke and would not be screening the Meg 2 for us. So I said, oh, that's fine. We don't need 4DX. It's fine. We'll just watch the regular Meg 2. And they said, oh, no, the entire cinema is subject to a blackout. So we had to hotfoot it up to the Angel Institute. No one has ever tried so hard to see a film. This is the point I'm making.
Oh, God. I mean, like, it was quite the experience. And then at the end of it, we watched the Meg 2, which we'll get into shortly. But yeah, I mean, it's been a very, very frustrating week. There was a great piece in The Guardian by Manuela Lazic about kind of the issue with trying to do film journalism when they're trying to fill these space with influencers. And, you know, Meg 2 is like such a perfect example because tiny screening room. We couldn't get in, even though we were doing coverage. And but then they did giant influencer screenings, which we were not allowed to go to.
Yeah, and they call it a fan screening. I mean, can you be a fan of something you haven't seen yet? I don't know. We know what they mean by fan screening. But also, it's really unfair because Layla and I are both big shark girls, you know? We were ready to love the Meg 2 and be on board that massive shark train. But anyway.
They served pizza at the press screening and someone said, like, the better the food, like the worse the film, which I thought was quite an interesting aphorism.
Yeah, it's not always true, is it? Because sometimes like the stunts, I mean, I remember at Bridesmaids, they had Andrex puppies, these cute little puppies being held by male strippers with their shirts off. And that's always stuck in my memory as an example of great film, great pre-screening stunt. But I think you're right about the food. It's specifically the quality of the food, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's the quality also, I think, of the things for you to take pictures in front of is a pretty bad sign. Like, normally if there's a really immersive experience as you enter, you're in for something pretty terrible ahead. But, you know, because I guess the incentive is to create good social media posts rather than the truth.
I like it when there's the total mismatch between the nature of the pre-screening razzle-dazzle and the film itself. So you remember The Northman, super serious. We've got Skarsgårds like battling through Vikings of the year 900 or something like that. And then in the Odeon West End, a DJ and a beanie cap dropping beats before The Northman. But you see, this is why the studios hate us. It's this kind of chat. The Instagram people are like, hey, wasn't it amazing? There was a DJ. Like, this is why this happens.
I don't believe in a lot of conspiracy theories, but I genuinely believe not one of those DJs has ever been plugged into anything. I think that it's just a little person stood at the front of the screen to kind of like create vibes. You know, like you do those sometimes at bat mitzvahs where you just get somebody whose job it is to kind of like keep the roof raised.
Yeah.
That, I believe, is the true purpose of that DJ.
I remember ages ago hearing about a widely touted director's spot at the LFF. Like, it was, oh, and we've got so-and-so to DJ. I think it might even have been Ben Wheatley. And it was absolutely a complete lie. It was just all playing out off of somebody's iPad.
Yeah. Well, we've been lied to in so many regards. I don't understand how we're supposed to have like faith in the world when they tell us that there is absolutely no place where the Meg 2 will be screening.
Are we visually recording this podcast? Because if we are, you can see my cat standing up against a wall. I've got pigeons nesting in my wall, grotesque baby pigeons that look like the sort of thing that the Meg 2 has at the bottom of the trench. They look like these underwater sea creatures. My cat is very interested in them. And now you all know about that irrelevant detail.
I have to say, I did find the image of those baby pigeons in your wall more distressing than anything in the Meg 2.
Which is a shame. It would be nice to be terrified by a movie like that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we might as well get into it. First up, it's the Meg 2.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Jonas Taylor leads a research team on an exploratory dive into the deepest depths of the ocean. Their voyage spirals into chaos when a malevolent mining company threatens their mission and forces them into a high-stakes battle for survival. Pitted against colossal prehistoric sharks and relentless environmental plunderers, they must outrun, outsmart, and outswim their merciless predators. So, Catherine, fellow shark girl, not that many sharks in this. Long stretches with few sharks.
On paper, it sounds like a masterpiece, doesn't it? I love all of those elements. But when you're sat there in the cinema, it doesn't really come together in the way that you would be hoping. Yes, there aren't really enough sharks. One of the sharks, they're toying with that kind of late stage Jurassic Park franchise idea of sharks that could be tamed by a sufficiently charismatic person. But this guy's not particularly charismatic, and they leave it kind of ambiguous as to whether the shark is really listening to him. I mean, fine if you needed to pad out the runtime, but it's like a good 2 hours already, this adventure with the megalodons. And I don't know. I mean, I love the idea of megalodons, but I think in both the first movie and in this, there's a sort of scale issue. Jaws is much scarier because the shark is a kind of a size that we can comprehend. These fishes, I would say they seem like they change size a little bit. Like sometimes they're big enough to swallow a small motor launch hull. Sometimes they're big enough to take out something the size of an oil rig. Sometimes they're interested in tracking down like a tiny dog called Pippin, that from the point of view of the shark, at the size at which it's been established, must be like, if you know, I'm trying to find a Tic Tac. I don't know, or something smaller than a Tic Tac. What's smaller than a Tic Tac? It's that kind of, I don't know. It just doesn't really come together as a villain for me, this shark or sharks.
Yeah. And their behavior. I mean, I love sharks. I spend quite a lot of time with sharks. That's a weird thing to say. Now, I scuba dive
that?
A lot. And like, I scuba dive a lot. And then I've also done a few times the thing where you go in the cage and you go and you see the big ones and stuff. Like, I really like shark obsessive.
I'm so jealous.
That's terrifying.
But fun fact about me, I also get terribly seasick. So I think I probably have the human record of having thrown up on the most sharks. And we're at about four.
So you're happier in the water with sharks than on the boat.
Well, it's the nature of scuba diving. There's always times where you've got to wait on the boat. And if it's more than 3 minutes and sharks turn to circle boats, I will be throwing up on a shark.
I'm glad I wasn't the only one who didn't grow out of like being seasick, because I was told as a child, like, oh, you'll be fine. Like, just wait till you're an adult. It never stopped.
No, lies. Lies that they told us. Yeah, sorry. Back to the Meg 2. Yasmin, for you, you came into this fresh. You had not seen Meg 1. I don't feel like that's actually required viewing, because like the plot here is pretty simple. But I mean, what did you make of this? Was it kind of what you expected? A kind of trashy, fun B-movie?
Well, I will confess, like, I'm not a shark girl. So I find sharks to be quite terrifying. And therefore, like, I don't really like watching shark films, because like when I am on occasion to be on holiday and be in the water, I don't want to think about the sharks being there. So in terms of this, I don't think it was what I expected, in that like it wasn't fun. Like, I thought it was going to be amusing. I feel that the tone isn't quite right. It's so self-serious, and I wish it was more goofy and entertaining. Also, like, I don't really love Jason Statham. Like, fun fact, I didn't realize as well that he was a diver. I assume you guys realize this, that he used to be a professional diver, so that's interesting to me. And also, like, his unwillingness to use a body double in the vein of Tom Cruise. But that doesn't really matter when it's like so CGI heavy. Like, why does it matter that he's not using a body double when he's like, you know, against a green screen? I just thought that was kind of a silly thing to add. And he's just not my like brand of diamond geezer. Like, I prefer a Ray Winston kind of character. He like, I feel like his face always looks like he's trying to make it into a fist, you know? He's just like so strange, and every delivery is a growl. I just like can't warm to him as a performer, I'm afraid. But also, I think with this film, it was kind of weird that the Meg wasn't the main predator, like in the final like big battle sequences. There are like two other creatures that are introduced, and I was like, why are you here? I thought the Meg was the apex predator.
Yeah, totally agree. There's about five different movies going on at once. There's like, you know, a movie where you're supposed to care about the annoying 14-year-old girl, sort of Scrappy-Doo type character, and that doesn't really belong to the same movie as cheering when the evil CEO lady gets chomped by, as you say, these ancillary creatures who show up in the final act. And also in the we should say, I guess, that this one has a kind of a prologue set, you know, in the distant millions and millions of years ago, with a T-Rex getting eaten by the Megalodon, which I think is where we first see creatures a bit like the ones that take over in the final act. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, that sequence is lifted from one of the novels. And in the novel, the Megalodon eats the T-Rex, and then we cut to Jonas, the Jason Statham character, explaining that, of course, T-Rexes and Megalodons never coexisted. They were from completely different periods in the fossil record. I've only described this to you now as part of my academic presentation, for a bit of fun, essentially. This film isn't doing that. It's just sort of showing you them coexisting, because I guess that's cool. I don't know.
I guess. I mean, was it cool? There's something like deeply uncool about this film. And like when they announced Ben Wheatley is this, I genuinely believed that he was doing it because he believed in this project. Like, I was like, you know, Barry Jenkins might be doing a Lion King 2 for the money. Questlove might be doing the Aristocats for the money. Sarah Polley, don't resent it. You go do Bambi for the money. But I thought that Ben Wheatley cared about these sharks. And we're going to get something so much better than the first one. And the weird thing is, it's almost exactly the same as the first one. And then the issue for me came is like, A, I kind of feel like I know too much about sharks to really like, you know, get on board with a lot of shark movies, because I'm just like, that wouldn't happen. And like, that isn't their behavior. And like, why would sharks be attracted to light? It's particularly ones that live in the dark. Like, that doesn't make sense as a motivator. Why would they want motors and not the sound of paddling? That would be instinctively the way that they would pursue prey. It would be stuff. I digress. But post the Titanic submersible disaster, I now also just understand way too much about submersibles to enjoy this movie.
The timing of that was pretty unlucky, wasn't it? We're all there going, well, actually, you know, 3,000 feet, you would be crushed to the size of a small... And then these guys are there going, it's 25,000 feet down, but Jason Statham can swim around outside. You know, he can do it because, like, fish can do it. And, you know, of course, fish that live in the Mariana Trench have adapted to those conditions. Some of them die, I think, if you bring them up to the surface, because that's where they're designed to live. We're designed to live on the surface. And you've got Jason Statham swimming around at 25,000 feet down. It's just, I don't know. I guess someone who hasn't seen the movie might say, yeah, but it's supposed to be a fun shark movie. Don't get so hung up on the science, guys. And the problem, I think, with this film is that it asks you to get hung up on the science sometimes. There will be these sort of scientific, pseudoscientific explanations for things. It's like, just junk all of that if you're going to do that kind of thing. It's like if you set a movie in space and spent a lot of time explaining how, like, the vacuum of space works, and then just decided it didn't matter and have had somebody go outside of the spaceship and sort of swim through deep space for a bit, and they were fine because they're hard as nails.
Or in this case, because he breathed through his nose.
Or something, yeah. Like, honestly, there are movies that I would defend that make those kinds of leaps of logic, but they're doing so from within the kind of movie where we're clued into the fact that but you're not supposed to expect it to hang together. The Meg keeps making these sort of lurches for an almost, I guess, Jurassic Park-like plausibility, at least the first Jurassic Park, where they did kind of try and keep things within the realms of scientific possibility, assuming you make that first leap of, we've brought dinosaurs back. I guess that's the problem. We've all got it in us to make one leap, and the leap in this movie is megalodons exist, and then it kind of wants us to make 10 additional leaps on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, it just, the more you kind of think about it, the more it does feel like something that was kind of cobbled together by a sort of marketing team who just knew that the first one made tons of money and didn't really want to do anything beyond that. I mean, Yasmin, for you, are you a Ben Wheatley fan?
This is the first Ben Wheatley film I had seen, actually. So I feel this was kind of baptism by fire. And looking at his filmography, it seems that he's done like a lot of different genres and he must have a distinct style. And I know that Scorsese and Edgar Wright are fans of him, but here was very workmanlike direction. So I don't really know what to think of him as a director based on this film, but maybe I should go and pursue some of his other work, I would say. I did have a problem as well with like how the underwater looked. I just feel like ever since Avatar, The Way of Water, I just can't look at underwater stuff anymore in the same way. It's just so murky and difficult to see what's going on. And there's a moment where like a shoal of fish come at them and it's just so blurred. And I just could not make sense of like the geography and the space of what was going on. And it was like extremely ugly. So that was my issue with how it looked.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Avatar, honestly, that was a film I actually left last year. I wasn't reviewing it and I'd sat through 90 minutes and I was like, I haven't sort of enjoyed a single second of this. So there's no real reason to think that I will like any more of it. And I left the cinema. Obviously couldn't do that with Meg 2. Because I was due on here in an hour or so after it finished. But yeah, it was this close, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have left. I mean, definitely for me, the final act is the best one because the final act is the one that actually gets fun. I did keep wondering whether Ben Wheatley actually in any sense directed this. And I'm so sad that this is your introduction to him, Yasmin, because he really is very good. But yeah, there was one kind of shot in the final act that is like the camera is basically from the perspective of like the sharks is like larynx. And I was like, there he is. That's my guy. And then it was done.
Most of the time, though, the shots are just like the shark coming at you again and again. And it just got really repetitive after a while. It does that thing that's such a pet peeve of mine to like play pop songs, like to make you feel good, like to ones that you remember. And so it's like simulating having a good time when you hear, what are the songs in it? Like the Gorillaz song.
Under Pressure is in there. Like, we see what you've done there because of the water pressure. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was either a Mandarin or Cantonese version of that Ting Ting song, which I'm blanking on the name of now. But yeah, it's just like, here's a song you know. You're having a great time, aren't you? And it's like, no, not really. You haven't put enough effort in for me to be having a good time.
Yeah, the characters all feel like they've sort of wandered in from different movies. You've got a sort of like a Michael Bay type guy going, oh, hell no, after the last time I got myself some skills. And, he's there. You've got this 14-year-old scrappy-doo character that is the one person I was hoping would get eaten by one of the sharks and you know, spoiler, but she doesn't. It's that type of movie. It would be great if the dog got eaten as well. And then a bunch of these people are sort of fairly interchangeable. And then Statham, who, I mean, I like Statham, and I think I would have despaired of this movie slightly more if not for his presence, but it didn't feel like he was kind of necessarily in the same film as everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a certain fondness for Statham, but I just, I think it's that thing, if you watch Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels at the right age, he sort of like embeds himself into you, and, you know, then it's just like seeing an old friend. But I could not understand why anyone thought that what we wanted was to see Jason Statham fighting other guys for like nebulous purposes around like money and protecting an environment, rather than bring back the fucking sharks. Like, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, there's like an 80s, 90s action aesthetic in there, jostling with all of the kind of Jurassic World and all of that. It's just muscle-bound guys in a jungle that looks like Nam with machine guns all of a sudden. You're like, which film have you... It's almost like, imagine if you imagine like a bunch of different studios all shooting different stuff at the same time. And then back in the golden era of Hollywood, they would sometimes shoot a studio quickie to make the most of the set. So this feels like they've shot kind of five studio quickies all at once, plus with the added joy of some fairly schlonky CGI.
Yeah. God, what a sad time we live in, that we made all of that effort to kind of come and see Ben Wheatley break our hearts. I mean, Yasmin, you at least managed to get into the press screening. Like, what was the atmosphere there? Would people seem like deeply disappointed?
There was a bit of laughter, actually, about with the Paige Kennedy quips that you mentioned, Catherine. I don't know if it was like that at your screening, but we had pizza, so people were in a good mood after that, if nothing else. I think, yeah, similarly to what you guys were saying, I think it was the end act that really brought people into it more, because that's where primarily the action is. Like, even though it's called Meg 2 : The Trench, the stuff in the trench is maybe the worst stuff in the whole film. It's just very boring. And then walking 3 kilometres and you don't really understand, are they close to their destination? Are they not? Like, and also people being eaten off screen as well. I'm just like, the whole point of these films is like the visceral chomp of being eaten by a shark. And the fact that the Megs just swallow these people whole, I thought was like a missed opportunity. And the fact that it's a 12A certificate as well, it's just trying to appeal to too many demographics rather than being like a shark attack film, which is what the people who are interested will like sign up to go and see.
Yeah, totally.
Christ, I didn't realize it was a 12A.
Yeah, I googled it.
I mean, that was, yeah. I mean, like, it just felt like with the first Meg, the resounding note that I was getting from everyone who watched it, who did think it was like perfectly fun or whatever, it's just like it needed to be way more violent, because otherwise, like, you just feel like you're kind of watching something of no substance. Like, the sharks aren't scary unless you have like a sense of like them, what it'd be like to be bitten by one. And like, there was no scary moment in this entire film. And then, but if you're not going to make it scary, why did they hire Ben Wheatley?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's like trying to make a Saw film without any traps in it or something. Like, what is that? It's just, you know, this is core to the premise of a shark movie, that we need to see people getting chomped, and that needs to be something other than a kind of dusting of CGI blood. It's another scale problem with the Megs, really, I think. And this is obviously not Ben Wheatley's fault. It's built into the premise. But these sharks can inhale a human being. And you're not getting that kind of glorious thing at the end of Jaws with Quint being chomped in half and gurgling around and the blood coming out of his mouth. Because with the Megs, it's just like, whoomph, and you're gone, which I think makes them inherently less scary than a regular-sized shark.
Yeah. Bigger, certainly not better in this case. I mean, is there anything to kind of... I feel like we're being kind of a bit of a bummer. Is there anything that you guys think to recommend this? Like, is there anyone you particularly enjoyed?
There's a couple of lines that were sort of so completely the line from, you know, a parody of this type of thing, that I got a sort of sideways chuckle out of them when people are saying, God, I can't remember it exactly. It's sort of stuff like, the impossible is now possible, like that kind of trailer speak. And there's such a lot of that, all that kind of snarky, quippy, I don't think this is a very good idea, I'll drink to that type of dialogue. And sometimes that was kind of almost to the point of super parody, and I was getting a kick out of that. I don't know, that's pretty thin, isn't it, for something to praise about the film?
I think that Paige Kennedy was probably the best part for me, just because he clearly was having fun. Like, I feel everyone else was just like there for a paycheck, you know, and he's making his little quips. Like, admittedly, they're not that funny, but he's having a good time. And I found that to be the most infectious out of the cast, who just generally look miserable to be there.
Yeah, that's true. You really want the actors to at least go for it and kind of believe in it in this type of movie. And yeah, I think you're totally right. Like, so many of them are just very wallpaper.
Yeah. I mean, I thought Paige Kennedy was pretty charming, but I was like, with the first Meg, there is this kind of running joke that he works in the ocean and he doesn't know how to swim. And just because you acknowledge that joke as being racist doesn't mean it's like not racist to write that for your black character. And then they kept doing it again in this one.
I think they're hoping that he can follow in the footsteps of LL Cool J in Deep Blue Sea, who is the charming chef who is also not in the oceanographic speciality facility because of his oceanographic skills. He's there because he's a chef. So he's like this literal fish out of water. And they're going for that, but they kind of mess it up.
Yeah, they certainly do. Oh, God, what a disappointing day. I mean, and I love sharks. You just need to put the sharks on screen. And then the film made me kind of depressed because I kept thinking about that poor Meg in the small area and then thinking about Blackfish and that little orca Tilikum and the miserable life they've had.
I don't know how they're keeping that thing captive. You can't keep great white sharks in captivity, like they die. So how are they keeping like the supersized version of a great white shark? I mean, it's not the sort of detail that this kind of film is inviting you to interrogate. But the fact that you end up wondering about that stuff is a problem with the film, because you ought to be having so much fun, you're not wondering about this stuff. That's the core of this. Like, obviously, we sound like the fun police coming up with our scientific reasons that this doesn't work. But this is what happens when you allow people's minds to wander in a film which should have no time for mind wandering.
Well. So Yasmin, we won't be inducting you into a shark film girl.
I'm resigning from shark film girl. I mean, between this and the Sharknado franchise, it's not been a good couple of decades.
Yeah, still just the good one. Just one really great one. And then we're holding out hope.
Hey, now, Deep Blue Sea, I will. Well, we'll come on to that later, right?
Yeah. I mean, good versus great, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, it does seem pretty unfair what we marine biology film fan Venn diagram people have been given.
I want to see it. Like, maybe it's always great whites, mako sharks, bull sharks and tiger sharks, because they're like the four most dangerous species of shark to mankind, right? But there are around 200, I think. I mean, Layla will know, around 200 species of shark. I know that, you know, in nature, most of them aren't dangerous, but can we have like some mutated evil forms of those other 200 species of shark? I think that could bring some much needed variety to the genre.
According to Jacques Cousteau, the most dangerous shark that he would ever feel was the oceanic white tip.
Ah.
Where's that guy's movie?
Nice. Yeah, we'll get him in.
Hammerheads, dangerous, because also dangerous. When you see one, you're about to see 50,000 more, because they travel in packs.
There we go. I mean, I don't know if any filmmakers are listening to this, but there are more sharks out there than you don't have to be bringing back the Megalodon every time. We've sort of tried him twice and it doesn't wildly work.
Ben Wheatley, if you're listening.
I hope he isn't. I'm guessing he is not going to read the reviews. I'm guessing he's not going to listen to the podcast. I think this was probably checkbook and thank you, next please.
Well, it is the famous story about Michael Caine, who missed the Oscars because he was making his terrible Jaws sequel. And he said that he'd never seen the film, but he really enjoyed the house in the Bahamas that it afforded him.
And that's a film that's like not any good at all, but it's still kind of more fun to watch than this was, I think. Even though the shark roars.
Shark does roar.
The shark roars in Jaws for the Revenge. It's also sort of psychically connected to Ellen Brody, Police Chief Brody's wife from the first one. She has these sepia-tinted visions of things that only her husband knew, but he's dead, so are they being psychically projected to her by the shark, maybe? Something like that? It's, yeah.
And it's so messed up, because that film establishes that poor Chief Brody died because of, like, fear, basically. And I was like, no, Jaws is about him conquering his fear. How dare you sully this man's legacy?
Yeah, totally, totally. I think maybe one of the reasons that the Meg one works a little bit better than this one is you've got those kinds of Jaws-type archetypes in there. Like, Statham's character in that one is more clearly, I think, the sort of Quint-type, tough man of the people, we'll go after this thing and get it for you. You've got the sort of Rainn Wilson from The Office, you know, Dwight from The Office playing the kind of billionaire. He plays him a bit like Elon Musk, which is funny. But, you know, that's like the evil mayor from Jaws. Those archetypes don't really exist in The Meg 2, I don't think. They just feel like pale copies of archetypes, which is not a good place to be in.
Oh, I'm sad now. Yasmin, you're not going to be inducted into our crew of shark fans. Oh, well. I'll do my best. I'll try and find you a couple of good ones.
Yeah, send me a list.
There's maybe three.
The Katy Perry shark had more charisma than this one, honestly.
But Yasmin, do you want to go first in getting some scores on this? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Okay, anticipation was probably a one because I hadn't seen the first one, not particularly interested in sharks, and not particularly interested in the work of Jason Statham, and hadn't seen a Ben Wheatley film, so a plethora of reasons, and also the fact that the studio were trying to hide it from critics, so I thought that they knew they had a stinker on their hands. And then I think enjoyment too, it was fine. It's just a bit dull. I found my mind wandering about, you know, the science as we discussed previously, and just wishing there were more shark attacks and things of that nature to keep me amused, because I was there to have fun and just did not have that much fun. And then in retrospect, probably a two. I'm glad we did this so soon after we watched the film, because I will have forgotten it by next week.
I hope that happens for me too. Catherine, what about you? What are your scores?
I'm going to say it's a 3-1-1. And like the three maybe was optimistic, but I was just holding out hope. It's sharks, it's Ben Wheatley, it's a summer movie, it's Statham, it's got lots of elements that I really connect with. And then, yeah, I just really struggled, and I think we'll continue to struggle. So, yeah, sorry, 3-1-1. That might be the lowest I've gone on the Little White Lies podcast.
And we made you struggle so much to go and see this film that you... Yeah, I think I'm at like 4-2-1. I was rooting for it. I was really rooting for it. I really love Ben Wheatley. I thought surely they'd let him make it a bit gnarly and scary in a way that like the first one was tired of being, but like, oh, what an absolute mess. And I don't understand how all of those themes can come together and be boring. Like the sin of the film is that it's also boring.
Yeah, like the only thing that it shouldn't be.
Yeah. Oh, moving on, we have a less boring film, I would say. It's Paris Memories.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
3 months after surviving a terrorist attack in a bistro, Mia is still traumatized and unable to recall the events of that night. In an effort to move forward, she investigates her memories and retraces her steps. So, Yasmin, I mean, this is quite a difficult film in, like, many ways, and one that kind of relies so much on a central performance of its actress in order to kind of, like, sell this journey, because it's a very much like an internal story about her coming to terms with trauma and, like, recapturing these memories. I mean, how did you find her performance?
I thought she was just fantastic. I love her. I think she's just such an interesting actress. I profiled her earlier this year, actually, and I think she kind of seemed to spring fully formed to, like, UK audiences, because we didn't see a lot of the rom-coms that she did, like, in France, that just were very culturally specific and didn't translate or get UK releases. So we kind of see her as this actress who, like, works with auteurs and things, but, like, she did have, like, quite a difficult path to get to where she is today, to be this, like, very renowned dramatic actress. And she won the César, like, the French Oscar, for this performance. And I just think it's so beautifully done, because, like, you can kind of see, like, the way the trauma affects her, like, on her face. She has such an expressive face, and she starts out, like, kind of quite dazed and shell-shocked, and then, like, you kind of see the emotion, like, bubbling up, and, like, there's never really these kind of, like, big cathartic moments that you'd expect from a film like this. And I think that's what makes it all the more powerful, is that she knows, like, how to keep the emotion bubbling under the surface and so dialed down. I just think it's a really nuanced and interesting performance. And I was surprised it kind of won an award, because I feel like acting like this never gets Oscars or things like that. So maybe it's just a kind of, like, Francophone quirk that they like performances like this. But this is the kind of acting that I really respond to.
And what about you, Catherine? Is this the sort of performance that you really respond to as well?
It's certainly the sort of performance that I admire. I think she's being asked to do an enormous amount to kind of carry the film purely through gestures, facial expressions. I mean, like you say, Yasmin, often the times when people get Oscars and things, there's, like, the obvious moment that's the Oscar clip, where they get to make a big speech or they sing I Dreamed a Dream or whatever it is. Like, there's the showcase moment. And this kind of doesn't have that. And so you do need a Virginie Efira for that kind of work. I love her. I mean, she's so brilliant in stuff like Benedetta. Like, she's got range. Benedetta is completely the polar opposite of this film. And I must say, Benedetta is more maybe where my kind of personal tastes lie. That's like a Paul Verhoeven film where she plays a highly sexual nun who takes over a convent in medieval times in Italy. And that's very much my jam. This is, like, not necessarily the kind of film that I naturally gravitate towards, but it's a really fine example of that sort of subtle acting showcase, and, you know, dealing with an incredibly tough subject.
Yeah, I mean, how did you feel, Yasmin, it kind of dealt with these, like, very sensitive issues? I mean, it's not an easy thing to take on both terrorism in some regard and kind of make it about somebody's, like, personal journey.
Yeah, I thought it was really interestingly done, actually. I don't know if you guys saw this film November, which treats this exact same subject matter, and it's starring Jean Dujardin. It came out, like, it had a very limited release in June, but essentially it's, like, the cop's point of view on this same attack. And so it's quite interesting to watch these two films in dialogue, because that one is very, you know, muscular and kind of propaganda, quite glossy. Like, it's entertaining, but it feels like a bit sensationalist in its, like, presentation of what happened. And there's only a very short scene with the victims of the attack, and it's kind of used to work out what happened and who the perpetrators were. Whereas this is, like, what I prefer, because it's more of a character study. And I like that it's not just Virginie's character as well. It kind of expands its approach. So it's, like, the cooks and the waitresses, and you get, like, voiceover starts being from her character and her point of view on it, but it kind of widens, and it's this kaleidoscope of all the different people who were affected. And I think it's very personal for the filmmaker Alice Winocour, because her brother Jeremy was there at the Bataclan attacks, and she apparently was texting him, like, while he was there hiding. So I just think it did it well, and I like that it didn't really it doesn't even say the word Bataclan. It doesn't deal with at all with the wider, like, sociopolitical context of it. It's very much just, like, in the headspace of the people who survived it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a film that kind of is very, like, preoccupied with, like, this woman's, like, headspace. But I'm wondering, was that able to, like, really sustain your interest, Catherine?
I mean, I did. I don't know that it has sort of an enormous amount of narrative momentum. I mean, does it need to? It's a character study. It's kind of one of those types of films where people would say, and also Paris is kind of a character in this film. I read your review, Yasmin, really good review. But like you say, it sort of gives a voice to a lot of those kind of minor characters within the film. But it, I think, sort of is nodding at the idea that actually in an event like that, there are no minor characters. They just happen to have picked this one woman as the kind of lens through which to filter all of this. I was actually in Paris about a month after the attacks and wandered past that kind of monument with all of the flowers that were laid there. And you could really feel the effect on the city. And I think they've done a really good job of evoking that. I mean, I suppose it's sort of the opposite of, you know, what in publishing would be a page turner. Like, it's a slow, measured film, and you do need to concentrate. You need to be in the right mood for it. It's not an escapist or a relaxing time at the cinema. So, I mean, I wouldn't sort of suggest it for a Saturday night date movie, but of course not all movies should be Saturday night date movies. It's dealing with an important subject.
Yeah, I mean, it did feel extremely true that, like, I only read about that personal connection that Alice Winnicott had with it afterwards. And, like, once you kind of see it through that lens, it's sort of immediately obvious. I mean, Yasmin, any final thoughts on Paris memories?
I like the way it, like, presented the trauma with these kind of flashbacks, but also, like, imagined memories and just, like, you're very much in her headspace the whole time. Like, that before the attack, you see someone receive a birthday cake with candles at the restaurant that she's at that is attacked. And then later in the film, like, you see the birthday candles again and, like, how that triggers her and, like, how her memory is so kind of malleable at that point as well. Like, if someone suggests that she had a selfish moment and she hid herself in the toilet and, like, stopped herself from being attacked, and then she imagines that happened, it's just, like, showing, like, how susceptible we are to, like, powers of persuasion at that time and, like, the difficulty of, like, you know, going through something that's as traumatic as this that can't really be understated.
Oh, well, we should get some scores on this in, like, a wild tonal shift from kind of the entirely unsubtle to the subtle. But Catherine, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment and in retrospect?
Probably a kind of a 4-3-3 for me, I think. I mean, Virginie Efira, I love her, so I'm always going to be a 4 or 5 for anything that she's doing. It's probably a 3 in terms of the experience watching it because of just that feeling that it was easier to respect and admire than kind of really go to bat for. And I don't think that feeling has really changed in retrospect. But I would say for anyone with a personal connection to the subject matter, you know, it's well worth a watch and probably would be a higher score.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, not that I'm wishing anyone has a personal connection with this sort of subject matter. Or with the subject matter in the Meg, that would also be very upsetting. Yeah, so what about you? What are your scores?
I'd probably go 4 in anticipation. Yeah, I love Virginie. I really liked Alice Winnicott's last film, Proxima, as well. And then, yeah, hard to talk about enjoyment with a film like this, but I think a 4, I think it was very effective. Like, I cried, I thought it was beautiful. And then 5, like, I've thought about this a lot. Like, this is one of my favourite films of the year. I just think it's fantastic. And yeah, as Catherine says, you have to be in the right headspace to watch it, but I think it is ultimately rewarding despite being difficult in terms of subject matter.
Beautifully put. I mean, yeah, I kind of feel like I'm vacillating between both of your opinions, and it would just be a case of, like, scores wise, those would be depending on kind of the mood that I was in that day. And yes, my brain's been frazzled by the Meg too, so I'm going to give it a couple of weeks before the rewatch. But funner times ahead with Rennie Harlan's Deep Blue Sea. Set in an isolated underwater facility, the film follows a team of scientists and their research on Mako sharks in order to fight Alzheimer's disease. The situation plunges into chaos when multiple genetically engineered sharks go on the rampage and flood the facility. So, Catherine, good shark movie?
Amazing shark movie. I mean, on the face of it, that synopsis doesn't sound too dissimilar to something like The Meg, but man, oh man, the difference with which it is executed. I really love this movie. I do have a sort of personal connection to it, although it's in terms of when I first saw the film, which was on a date with my boyfriend when I was 16. We went to the cinema to see this. I've still got this ticket stub somewhere because I'm a big keeper of things. And then by the time it came out on DVD, I was dating somebody else. And so we had a cute little date at home watching Deep Blue Sea.
I love this. That could be like an upstyle montage of your, like, love life, but each time Deep Blue Sea is
yeah,
there.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether it ever came out on Blu-ray, but I could track down a Blu-ray and watch it with someone. Deep Blu-ray Sea, something like that. No, I love this one. It's very much a time capsule. It's very kind of late 90s in its approach to lots of aspects, not least the fact that it's got real sharks in it. We see footage of actual sharks. It's got mechanical sharks, you know, big animatronic guys. And there is a bit of CGI in there as well, but it's before the sort of CGI rot set in within the industry. They'll use it to beef something up rather than to just replace things that should really be done with animatronic sharks. I mean, I'm not going to argue that live sharks ought to be used to make Hollywood movies, but
I'd argue for that.
Where you have the chance to use good stock footage, I don't know why that's become such a no-no, when real shark, albeit filmed under other circumstances, will always look better than a CGI shark for my money. But yeah, a wonderful array of characters in this. Saffron Burrows as like the least likable science lady ever. She's the one who is desperately trying to find the cure for Alzheimer's by genetically engineering sharks to be super smart. We're told time and time again a very intelligent lady, but it doesn't come off on screen. Test audiences famously hated her character so much that when she survived at the end, they gave the film such low ratings that they went back and reshot the ending so that she died, and Thomas Jane and LL Cool J are the two that survive, which must have felt heartbreaking for Saffron Burrows to have to be called back for one day of filming in a tank, just the way you get eaten, because that's what the test audience have demanded happened to you. It's also got Thomas Jane, who's a bit of a Neely man in the world of action cinema. Yeah, he kind of could have been a Keanu Reeves or a you know, Bruce Willis or something like that, and it never quite came together for him. But he does look good in a wetsuit, and he plays the hero well. LL Cool J, we actually talked about a little bit in the Meg section, but he plays this chef who's a real fish out of water. He's there with the quips and the wisecracks and a bird. He's very religious and is constantly talking to Jesus, and I don't know, the charisma just shines through with that one. Plus he got to do some songs for the soundtrack, which I highly recommend you seek out LL Cool J's Deep Blue Sea soundtrack contributions. And like so many great little bit players, Michael Rapaport, a lot of people know him from Friends. He played Phoebe's boyfriend for a bit, and he's kind of his name says it all, really. He's called Tom Scoggins. And you've even got
I do like that they cast Michael Rapaport as a really smart guy. I love that.
Yeah, it's cute. And Stellan Skarsgård, if you please, as one of the first victims, and he plays that real nice and naturalistic, like just before he dies he's lighting up a cigarette, and his partner kind of looks at him like, oh God, you really should quit smoking, it's not good for you. And I think it just does something sort of subliminal. You're just there kind of going like, yeah, you know, so these two are fully rounded characters, they're probably going to be in this for a while, and then the shark that they've tranquilized at this point suddenly comes back to life and rips his arm off. And I won't spoil for anyone who hasn't seen the film his subsequent journey from there, but it is a doozy. I'm just monologuing now about all the characters in Deep Blue Sea, but I feel like I should let you guys chip in.
No, it's true, because if people talk about like that Psycho reference as if it's like that your kind of famous actor dies like 8 minutes in. No, Marion is there till the halfway point. It's way more exciting when that's the point where they unexpectedly get taken out. Spoilers for you, I suppose.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about Samuel L. Jackson, who is the guy that gets constantly referenced as checking out a bit earlier than we thought he would in this. But I think the real coup is that he gets taken out in the middle of an inspirational speech. I just don't think it gets better than that. To be Samuel L. Jackson giving you the, and we're going to buckle down and we're going to band together and we're going to beat this thing, and then chomp right in the middle of it. It's so funny. It's exactly what I wanted to happen to that 14-year-old girl in the Meg.
Yeah. I mean, that feels harsh to say about a child, but I am.
Annoying on-screen children are subject to completely different rules for me. For filmmakers, they're subject to the rule that they always survive. For me, they're subject to the rule that like they should go. They're annoying. I would never wish harm. Probably don't need sense. I would never wish harm on an actual child. But annoying children in films, like it was such a thing in the 80s and 90s, the precocious child. And then I think people realised it was annoying and stopped doing it for a while. And now apparently they're back.
Yeah, unless you watch Face Off, in which case that kid gets killed in like the first 3 minutes. I was very surprised when I rewatched that. Yasmin, for you, is this a first watch or a rewatch?
I had never seen this film. I never heard of this film, to be honest with you. So yeah, it was a first watch for me. I had more fun than The Meg 2, you'll be pleased to hear. Yeah, I did enjoy that bit with Samuel L. Jackson. I think LL Cool J was the really like shining star for me. I just really, even if he like subscribes to that whole trope that I hate, where like people in films act ridiculously and it's clearly like bending over backwards so that the plot makes sense. Like there's a moment where his hand is bleeding and the shark's in the water, but he leans over the water to try and save his parrot, and you're just like, why are you doing this? Okay. But yeah, it's a really fun scene where he gets trapped in an oven and somehow the shark with its fin manages to turn it to 500 degrees. So that was very exciting. I thought that the action was a lot better than in The Meg, and it kept me engaged, even if it was quite, you know, silly and ridiculous in parts. But that's what you want from this kind of film, to be honest.
I love it. The kind of sharks have this thing of like, oh, they're super intelligent now, but like their skills do go from understanding how ovens work, like having this very complicated plot by which they're kind of sinking the facility in so they can kind of escape into the out water. And then at one point, they can swim backwards. Who knew?
And also, like, sorry to bring up James Cameron yet again, but like there were certain scenes where it just kind of looked like Titanic, and it just like the comparison suffered for me, because there's so many of those like long corridors and the watertight doors and the scenes of people running away in slow-mo and the water coming behind them. And also even the way that Safran Boas takes the like shark protein out of his mouth is very similar to Avatar The Way of Water, the way you take the whale elixir thing. It just made me think of James Cameron quite a lot.
I don't know if really Renny Harlin would even be mad about that. I think you're right. It's they, you know, Titanic was so recent, 1997, right? And this is 99, and they would have been making it in 1998, right after Titanic had come out. So it's clearly water is having a moment when this film is released. And I always feel bad for Deep Blue Sea because it came out the same summer as The Blair Witch Project, and no one knew that was going to be a huge success. So they didn't kind of counter-program it. It wasn't like, oh, let's all get out of the way of the massive new movie, The Blair Witch Project. So nobody knew, and a ton of kind of films got buried by it. And I think Deep Blue Sea sort of unjustly so. Everyone went to see Blair Witch and not Deep Blue Sea, which I prefer Deep Blue Sea. That might be a maverick, a lone wolf opinion, but yeah, I think it stands up.
I don't feel like I have to choose me my children of Deep Blue Sea and The Witch Project.
I just say I love the LL Cool J music video. I would definitely recommend watching that, kind of like Busby Berkeley style, like dancing in the water, and he's like rapping about being the shark. I think the theme tune that's played in the credits is called Deepest Blue brackets Shark's Fin. So yeah, would recommend a Google.
Yeah, he is a real gift to that film, actually. And I do think that it is interesting kind of looking at him with the sort of similar comic relief that was in Meg 2, where like LL Cool J does actually have a reasonably rounded out character. He's not just like an object of ridicule. At one point, he explains the theory of relativity really well. he's utterly charming.
They've given him a bit of backstory. Like, we understand, I think, that he's given up drinking. And then when the sharks come along, he like takes a swig, and then some more bad shit happens. And he's like, okay, you know, talking to God, like, I see your message. It's just, you know, it gives the actor something to get his teeth into, pun unintended.
Well, I mean, I'm very sad that I kind of watched them in this order in a way. I would have liked to have very much done Deep Blue Sea as a balm to Meg 2, where it's actually just, it's able to be silly without being like contemptuous of its audience. But before we go, we've got one last thing. You guys are going to give us some non-movie recommendations for the week. Yasmin, do you want to go first? What's your non-movie recommendation?
Yes, it is a play that is currently on in the West End at the Gillian Lynn Theatre. It is called Crazy for You, and it's a revival of the 1992 musical that has like Gershwin music, Ira and George Gershwin's music. And it's just like the most joyous time that you will have at the theatre. It's like a real putting on a show kind of musical. It's got all the like 1920s jazz standards that you'll be familiar with, you know, like Embraceable You and Stairway to Paradise and things like that. And it's just really great dancing as well. Like tap dancing just like scratches a certain part of my brain. I just love it so much. And there's a scene where like a woman does tap dancing on point shoes, which I'd never seen in my life, and was having the best time. And the lead is this guy Charlie Stemp, who I wasn't familiar with, but he kind of reminded me of like a James Marsden kind of figure. And it's just like a really good fun time. Would recommend for people who love like Gene Kelly musicals. It kind of reminded me of An American in Paris and Summer Stock and things like that.
God, you had me at tap dancing on point. That sounds incredible.
Like, it was mad. I just couldn't believe how she was doing it. It was just like, also she was on this big desk as well. So she was like really like elevated. And then she's got like, I don't know, it's like metal on the like end of the point shoe. So you can hear it as if it were a tap shoe. It was very cool.
That sounds absolutely amazing.
Catherine, what about you? Do you have a recommendation?
These don't have to be topical or contemporary or anything, do they? They can just be something we've been into this week. I've been revisiting a whole bunch of Jane Austen stuff. So I listened to the Rosamund Pike audiobook of Sense and Sensibility again. She does such a good job. Like, she kind of, I think she's slightly borrowing from like the Emma Thompson version of it. So for example, her Edward Ferrars kind of sounds a bit like Hugh Grant, and that's a lot of fun. And then off the back of that, I dug back into the Jane Austen ephemera because I was like, is there any of her stuff that I haven't read? And there's this book of Lady Susan, the Watsons, and a third one that I haven't read yet, but I read Lady Susan and the Watsons. They're kind of, Lady Susan wasn't published in her lifetime. The Watsons wasn't published in her lifetime, I don't think, and was incomplete as well. It was great joining the dots of Jane Austen. I think what I'm going to do after I'm off this podcast is get in the bath and read the third one, whose name I've forgotten. But yeah, always fun to kind of go back to classic authors that you love and feel like you know inside out and just check if you really have read all of them.
Yeah, a stone cold take. Jane Austen is good.
I know, right? There's this lady on the banknotes. Don't know if you know her. I've discovered her.
Oh, yeah. No, it is that Barbie movie thing of like, there is something like that is just so comforting about settling down on a day that you feel slightly sad or slightly happy and just enjoying some time with old Jane. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's The Haunted Mansion, and I got to talk to its director, Justin Simeon. We'll also be looking at Rom-Com, Red, White and Royal Blue. And for Film Club, we're watching The Old Dark House. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Catherine Bray and Yasmin Omar. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.